Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, America. This is the Black Freedom Network. I'm your host of the program. Well, we've got a number of different names. In fact, we'd like to be somewhat clandestine, if you will. But it's On Point Black Political, Black whatever. But this is the Black Freedom Network, my friends, coming to you from our mobile facility here in the beautiful Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. Temperature is 79 degrees. I tell you, my friends, it is beautiful here in the Twin Cities. We haven't had as much rain as we probably would like to have, but pretty much in April, May, and June, we got drenched. But it is a beautiful day. A lot of activities going on, if you will. Just a shout-out to my co-host, Don Allen, who's not with us again this afternoon. He's in the East, in Washington, D.C., in fact, on some family business, if you will. And so we wish him and the family the best out there. And, you know, continue to observe and examine Washington, D.C. There's just all kinds of problems out there. President's really got a problem on his hands with respect to what's going on in Egypt. The military, everyone, you know, wants to pretend didn't pull a coup d'etat a little over 6 weeks ago in the ousting of President Morsi, if you will, who we hope he's still alive. I've seen the United States, unfortunately, participate in coup d'etats. Allende in Chile comes to mind in the early 1970s, where the democratically elected head of state is overthrown by the military coup, if you will, and then comes up dead, if you will. You know, just hope the best. It clearly appears that the military is absolutely committed in Egypt to annihilating, for our international audience, to annihilate the Muslim Brotherhood, if you will. You know, for over 80 years, the Muslim Brotherhood has been about trying to achieve its philosophy, its doctrine, if you will, and et cetera, through peaceful means. And the events of the last 72 hours have been just absolutely brutal. I mean, seeing a bulldozer running over a woman, an older woman, attempting to protect a young man who had been shot and wounded, both of them killed, if you will. Snipers, army snipers, by the way, military snipers, many of them trained by American military advisors, shooting from high ground, if you will, killing and maiming and injuring many. The latest casualties as of just before we went on the air, over 800 dead, probably more than 1,500 to 2,000 injured. And contrary to what, you know, our network and cable types are being told that they must espouse, we're on the verge of, well, they're on the verge, because we're certainly living in peace and tranquility, you know, in most places in America, that we're on the verge of seeing a civil war in Egypt, which is going to do a lot for the stability, financially and otherwise, because isn't it interesting already, because there may be a threat to the Suez Canal, in which so many of those big super tankers that can get through the canal, if not, then they have to go around, you know, the Horn of Africa, or they have to go across the Pacific, well, first of all, through the Indian Ocean and then into the Pacific and to the west coast of the United States. But we're already being told, price gas man getting ready to shoot up again. Probably be up by 60, 70 cents by Labor Day, which isn't that far off. But anyways, that's the international scene causing a lot of problems for the Obama administration. We just, you know, hope that our president can get a handle on it. But, you know, we got enough problems right here in Twin Cities. We don't have to go to Washington or Egypt, if you will, or Iran or Afghanistan or Iraq, North Korea, you know, coming back around the horn. We can get it right here. But let me also do this. A shout-out. A lot of activities going on at North Commons in North Minneapolis, if you will. This is a interesting day. We just returned, if you will, from a beautiful outing and a beautiful activity conducted by a woman by the name of Alicia Clement. She's been a caller here on these programs on a number of occasions, a former Minneapolis police officer, if you will. And she put together, because she's got a lot of nieces and nephews and et cetera, and she hears the young people talking about, you know, how important really a bike is. And the children don't know it's also equally important to adults, because the way the economy is going and the inability to afford insurance and be able to keep your license and all those kinds of things. A whole lot of people are, you know, riding them bikes and hitting that sidewalk and pavement with them rubber shoes. But anyways, Ms. Clemons set out on a Pacific venture, got the support of a number of elected politicians and others. Just kind of a shout-out to State Representative Ray Dean, first term DFL 58B, who was there, participated in the bike giveaway. Apparently was not intimidated by, I don't know, some disheartening kinds of things that seemed to happen with respect to this event, if you will. Ms. Clemons soliciting a number of individuals to participate, and 21 very happy faces, just around 2:05. The official event took place. Bike officers of the Minneapolis Police Department, and a shout-out to them, if you will, for going out and coming over and working with the young people who are receiving these brand-new bikes. I got to tell you, man, you know, I come out of the old school and the Schwinn bike and the J.C. Hickenbopper bikes. You know how old I am. Where the state of art, where the Cadillacs and the Mercedes-Benz and et cetera. Well, a couple bike officers from Minneapolis MPD are there. We're there, and they are working with the young people, 21 very happy children, all children, ages basically 10 to 12, were the winners based on a written essay, if you will. Subject matter determined by the sponsors and Ms. Clemons, who's been very much involved in education. And the 21 recipients judged to have the best essays. So, you know, there was a little work, brain work, if you will, that had to go into this particular event. And so we had a chance to go there, congratulate Ms. Clemons, say a couple words to some of the young people. It was refreshing. Let me say it like this. It was refreshing to see so many parents there. A lot of grandmothers, by the way, though. A lot of grandmothers there making sure their grandbabies were taken care of. But it does good to see these smiles. Helmets, by the way, given away. Ms. Clemons able to solicit the helmets and et cetera. Of course, she did not have the corporate power that we saw just over the hill there from the tennis court where, she was kind of relegated to the tennis court, but she had no problem carrying out that responsibility and being due diligent. A lot of big corporate tents there as the barbecue cook-off between black firefighters and black police took place. And boy, I'm telling you, people are going to be eating good. They should be eating good right now. It's approximately 3:09 Central Standard Daylight Saving Times here in the Twin Cities. Every corporation and organization who was there was paid to be there. For whatever reason. A couple of big-time stars, if you will, a entertainment stage, if you will, and judges, the two black state senators were, I guess, two of the judges, the chiefs of both departments, and then there was a mystery person as the fifth judge, as I understand it. But what I was impressed with as a long time, like let's say 1945 resident of this city in North Minneapolis, was to see those happy, smiling faces, particularly at a time when there is so much turbulence in our city and there's such a significant problem, if you will, between the community and police based on race, if you will. I know folks don't like to talk about that. That's an elephant in the room. Want to try to stay away from that. But it's a fact. And in that regards, we called attention to the, what is it now, in the last 10 days, 5 articles, 3 of them right on the front page of our beloved paper, the Minneapolis Star Tribune, talking in terms of police misconduct. Of course, much has been, and by the way, we will be touching on the whole story by the Star Tribune on alleged evidence found against the deceased young man, Terrence Terrell Franklin, shot to death, head blown off by police inside a house at 2717 Bryant Avenue South in our city on the 10th day of May in the year of our Lord, 2013. But back to North Commons and the event, if you will. you know, big corporate came through over 400 pounds. My, you know, to my friends out there at the other parts of America, you know, where maybe malnutrition and et cetera is a problem, hey, we get it done here in Minneapolis if, you know, the right political institution gets involved. 400 pounds of ribs, baby, being cooked out there. The best of equipment, if you will, the Minnesota Rib Association or Society made sure that happened. Cubs, the big wholesaler, retailer here in Minnesota, and others donating 400 pounds of ribs and 1,500 of the top of the line Frankfurters. Man, them Frankfurters is better than the ones they charge you $10 for down at Target Field and at the Metrodome. You know what I'm saying? I mean, top of the line stuff, man. And so, you know, that was great, if you will, but I think the effort put together by Ms. Clemens certainly surpassed that, if you will, as it pertains to getting out, being well organized. And like we said, Minneapolis police bike officers there to help with issues of safety, how to ride your bike, how to control your bike, how to preserve your bike, really. And that is so important to children. So a shout out to everyone, but particularly Alicia Clemens, who has called the program sometime, and we've gone back and forth with her, if you will. But, you know, what she provided for community and for the children, you know, you kind of wish you could get more of that, you know. And in many respects, many of us adults, if you will, are at fault for not, you know, putting our energy into some of that, but you also have to put energy into economic opportunity for the parents of these children, you know, because if mother and dad are not working, you know, these children are not going to have opportunity for these bikes. And I'm telling you, like I said, these, I come out of the old bike school of Schwinn Bike and J.C. Higginbotham, if you will. I repeat again, state of the art. And those were some heck of a bikes that I saw given away this afternoon. By the way, as we move into the big story right now, again, I'm Ron Edwards, co-host of the Black Freedom Network, BFN, if you will, in concert with our associates on the West and East Coast, if you will, network being pulled together. It will be, we think, will be in a couple of years. It takes time, you know, because nobody wants to give you any money to lay out the black point of view. Oops. You know, I remember we thought we had that with BET, but Brother Johnson ran into some problems with his marital things. Wife took half of his half of his wealth, and then he sold the BET network off, and it's never been the same. And so we continue to look for our CNN and CBS and, not Fox, by the way, but anyway, some of those networks. And one of these days, maybe it'll come our way. In fact, our associate, Mr. Allen, is in some discussions, preliminary discussions, in Washington, D.C. about expanding BFN, Black Freedom Network, if you will, and trying to bring aboard more reflections, more opinions, more points of view, and begin to get that black perspective, if you will. Interesting situation, by the way, in Missouri, where a clown, white clown, decided to do a depiction of putting a broom up the anal of a person who was made up to look like President Barack Obama. Folks say they don't see anything wrong with this. Hardliners, if you will, say don't see anything wrong with this. And President Obama has to understand that he is a public servant, and consequently he can be held up to public ridicule. That, you know, that is BS. I mean, you know, I have, you know, been a quote-unquote adult, if you will, since the late 1950s, voted in my first election in 1960, haven't missed one since. Ain't no way in the world that these folks talk about white presidents or their family or their children or such. The closest anybody ever came, and I got to give it, I well remember President Harry Truman back 1949, a guy for the New York Times, I think it was, music critic criticized President Truman's daughter, his only child, by the way, and the recital she did because she was involved with music and piano and et cetera. And I mean, old Harry Truman, President of the United States, said, if I catch you out somewhere, I'm going to bust you right in the mouth. I mean, he said, hit him in the nose kind of thing. And, it just became understood that those kinds of personal attacks, I mean, to be out there at the rodeo where this took place in Missouri there, by the way, the white clown has been barred from doing anything anywhere in Missouri, but somebody will pick him up, to take a broomstick or whatever and play like you're running it up the president's anal, if you will, you know what I mean? That's pretty dangerous stuff. And the reason I say that is I just go down the roadways, and I told my homies in Idaho, who we oftentimes give a shout out, some of the most dangerous white extremists and supremacists in the world out there in Idaho. But a place, and some of you used to go down there way before the days of the superhighway, used to go through there, get stopped, get tickets, and et cetera. Place called Harrison, Arkansas. I got to tell you, man, last night I saw a documentary on Harrison. Now, Harrison, Arkansas, nice white town. In fact, they indicate that they're the safest white city in America. And they maintain that Negroes are really not welcomed in Harrison, Arkansas. For those of you that would dream of finding a town like Harrison, Arkansas, it's to the east of Fayetteville. That's the University of Arkansas, Springdale. And right up there where Walmart has its headquarters in Bentonville and Rogers, Arkansas. But it's right there on Old 65. Let's say you were going down to Little Rock and you took Old 65 all the way down to Conway and then drop down into Little Rock, if you will, Harrison. And, boy, they actually have the signs. They say, we are the home of the Ku Klux Klan. And so, you know, I've been aware for quite some time of some of the training camps that my old homie has down there in Harrison, Arkansas. And for some of you black folk up in St. Louis and even as far north as Kansas City and definitely down in Little Rock, if you will, who are always confronted with these mysterious deaths and disappearance of African Americans and particularly children and et cetera, turn your eyes to Harrison, Arkansas. They have a high school. The high school there has 600 students. Two of them are African Americans, and both of them are of mixed race, if you will. And I tell you, them people in Harrison talk about how to do it, man. they say, we Klan country, we vigilante country, you know. And niggers is, you know, that's the kind word, niggers is not wanted here in Harrison. But again, we call out a shout-out to our homies down there. By the way, you guys got a nice practice facility and torture facility, really. That's the reason we talked about black children and black people disappearing, showing up dead. The Klan got a nice torture facility and camp in a little old town called Jasper, Arkansas. Down there not far from the Buffalo National Park. I tell you, these boys know how to operate. It's like my buddies out there in Idaho. They get up there in them heels, if you will, and et cetera. And, man, they do all kinds of things. And sometimes when, you know, people see them white and black vans traveling through their towns going down towards Jasper, they don't pay any attention to who's in those vans, if you will, never to be seen again. But, again, for our federal authorities who never can seem to find these training camps and these facilities, Jasper, Arkansas, you understand, tied right in with the Klan. And Grand Wizard Ropa up there in Harrison, Arkansas. So I had told some of my homies that I would give a shout-out today on the program because the Klan members up there in Harrison, Arkansas, have sent out a message to black America that the Negroes need not. Let me tell you how bad it is in closing. There is one fairly good-sized industry there, and it's FedEx, but FedEx can't, even the hospital there in Harrison cannot find any doctors, white or whatever else, and God help you if you are a person of color who, you know, is going to do an internship or et cetera, white folks tell you down there, we do not want your black hands on our white bodies, but anyways, FedEx does have a big distribution center down there, and they've tried to hire African Americans. What's happened? It is so bad down there, man. It is so dangerous. Their brothers would rather take the 40-50 mile drive back up to Bronson and stay in a motel than stay in the area of Harrison, Arkansas. That's just how dangerous it is down there, if you will. But you have to kind of laugh because it is a part of America's true culture, if you will, and it's also a part of the the dangers that are going on. I mean, the hatred and animosity. I mean, when you talk about what the clown did up there in Missouri at the rodeo, you know, talking about a depiction, you know, of the president of the United States, just go to show you what kind of disdain and hatred these folks have for us in Black America. But you keep on shucking and jabbing and making yourself believe that these people love you, okay? You'll continue to disappear, and you'll continue to find your loved ones laying in the middle of the street. See, all that violence is that everybody talks about is black-on-black crime. No, folks, it ain't all black-on-black crime. But we're just not sophisticated or mature enough at this point in time, on the very serious note, to really not only have the discussion but, you know, order and request the kind of, and even mandate the kind of requests for more thorough investigations with respect to what happens all around this country, including right here in the Twin Cities, where we have so many unsolved what is called cold case. You know, the case done grown cold. That's because your body's cold. But anyways, hell, you know, just want to give that shout out to our buddies. And for those of you that ever make the mistake of going down Old 65, do not stop for gas or nothing else in Harrison, Arkansas, unless you want to, quote unquote, become a statistic and a number. Bad town, bad place, buddy. Woo! What more can I say? Well, a lot of discussion going on. Let's give you a specific date that the community should be interested in. I'm not sure if organizations and leadership could be. On September 9th through the 12th, Hennepin County Grand Jury here in Minneapolis. Minneapolis is the county seat of Hennepin County. Minneapolis being the largest city in the state, Hennepin County being a very rich county. Big government here in Hennepin County, but we're, you know, they're Democrats. Now, that doesn't mean a lot of black folks are working in county government, but, you know, big government. I mean, you know, a lot of programs, a lot of big salaries. Hennepin County is kind of the watershed, if you will, with regards to what's going on, what's happening, kind of sets the tone, if you will, for what is supposed to happen. And so that means that it's county attorney, and in this case it's a Democrat. He's been in office a long time. His father was a beloved governor in this state way back in the 1950s, our Orville Freeman. We used to tell jokes and laugh about Orville because of that first name, but he was a good man, good governor. Son, not cut from the same cloth, if you will, as his daddy, as Orville. But Mike Freeman has been the county attorney here, and myself and a couple other writers for the largest black newspaper and oldest black newspaper here in the state of Minnesota, Spokesman Recorder, have written about him. And, in fact, in a column under my byline about 5 weeks ago, I pointed out that we've never had a police officer indicted here in anywhere in the state of Minnesota for the wrongful death of a citizen of color, be it Native American or black or whoever else. And so there was a copyrighted story, front page Minnesota Spokesman Recorder last week, in which the top reporter for the Spokesman Recorder, Charlie Hallman, did a interview with Mike Freeman. And I'll just leave it for those that, you know, want to go back and take a look at the story, because Mike Freeman said there's never a circumstance where a police officer would use his weapon and take the life of anybody with malice and forethought. See, that's a legal term. It means mean-spirited, very mean-spirited. And that's fascinating. But I had written in my column about 5 weeks ago that the last time, the closest we ever came was 35 years ago, when a police officer in Eagan, Minnesota, which is a suburb south of here, shot and killed a young man who was the son of the just retired at that time Minneapolis Civil Rights Director, the late Robert Benford. His son, Eric Benford, gunned down in a filling station by a police officer who said he thought, as he asked the young man to show him identification. By the way, the young man was home on leave from the United States Army, getting ready to be shipped out to Germany, with later he was to be deployed in Southeast Asia, if you will. Officer told him to show some identification. Young man reached for the backpack. Officer blew him away. Came within one vote in the federal grand jury back then in indicting the police officer, and that's the closest a state or federal grand jury has ever come in indicting a white police officer for, you know, malfeasance in office. That's like, you know, murder with intent, with malice and forethought. And so we were not surprised just 2 days ago here in our beloved Shangri-La when a interesting article appeared under the byline of a reporter by the name of David Chenin. Mr. Chenin was the focus, if you will, of reflections by me and my colleague who is not with us this afternoon, Mr. Don Allen, about a story that he and Matt McKinney, who is actually the crime reporter, actually succeeded Mr. Chenin when Mr. Chenin was kind of pushed out for some disciplinary reasons and sent to an outlying county to handle the news for the paper out there. But on the 17th of May, I want to give these dates because they all become crucial as we now move into the column of yesterday. And the so-called sensational expose and revealing information about what they identified as DNA that was found on an MP5 submachine gun that allegedly Mr. Franklin, now deceased, allegedly shot two officers, white SWAT officers, by the way, in the basement of the home at 2717 Bryant Avenue South in the city of Minneapolis. So we were not surprised, as we said before. The timing of the article once again raises the issue of leaks. I mean, there are serious leaks in law enforcement here. We're not just going to pick on the MPD, because we know that Chief Janae Arto is doing all that she possibly can to try to straighten these situations out. But after situations like Apple Valley, Minnesota, Green Bay, Wisconsin, the Franklin situation, and numerous others, some of which are reflected in this morning's edition of my beloved metropolitan paper, the Minneapolis Star Tribune, who talks about these cases. And 59 of them, 59, I mean, you know, over there in the federal courts, 59 cases in which allegations of police misconduct, brutality, and et cetera, are being alleged. Now, one thing about the federal courts in this country, you cannot bring frivolous legal issues. You know, federal judges will throw you under the jail, fine your attorneys, throw them in jail too, and cite you and make it more difficult for you ever to bring a case in the federal court. If the court decides that you were being frivolous, that, in other words, this is just a bunch of BS, well, the city of Minneapolis, as of the writing of this story in this morning's edition of the paper, and then we'll go back to yesterday, Randy First, senior reporter, correspondent for the Minneapolis, the Minneapolis Star Tribune, reports that there are 59 current cases over in the federal system being either prepared for trial or negotiations or going on, if you will, conference hearings and et cetera to, you know, have the city to continue to pay out the kind of money that they've been paying. And actually, this city has paid out, though the figure in the paper is $14 million, it's been a little bit more than that since 2006. This city just pays the taxpayers' money out to deal with these cases. 59 cases. And ranges, and let me say one case that for our listening audience across the world and in the country, a year ago, a young African American, made a mistake of being downtown. Police did not like how he responded to them, began to beat him, and et cetera. Brother had dreadlocks. See, one of the things you find out here, because Mr. Franklin, unfortunately, had dreadlocks also, one of the things you find out here in Minneapolis is that you got to be careful with your dreadlocks, because they have learned, as a part of, I guess, the training here in Minneapolis in our police department, to grab them dreadlocks and use that like as a leverage to kind of hold your head and pound you in the head, if you will, beat you in the head. Well, in the case of the young man in the case cited in this morning's edition, this is not something we're making up here at Black Block Radio, if you will. This comes from, you know, the Minneapolis Star Tribune, but most importantly, it comes from the files of the Federal District Court for the Federal District of Minnesota. Man, they whipped this brother so bad and grabbed his dreadlocks that they actually pulled out a dreadlock. They actually pulled it out of his scalp, you know. Now, I got to tell you, friends, that's pretty hard to do. I mean, but, and it's got to be painful, but it's also got to send you a signal that you are within seconds of death, if you will. And so this comes out in the story, and there were some other things that came out in the story. But what was troubling, there was a case that they had, the Star Tribune had. I do not know why they chose not to cite that case and share it with the general public, in which a police officer who was African-American was actually being cited in the story as a hero and one of those that had crossed the thin blue line. And God dang me, the Star Tribune made a political decision prior to going to press last night that they didn't think it would serve any purpose to display and portray an African-American police officer as a hero. I got to tell you, man, we got some funny politics up here. Now, as we said before, there have been a number of front-page stories on our beloved newspaper, the Star Tribune, about, you know, problems with the police. And like we said, this chief is doing everything she possibly can to try to get this thing straightened out. I don't know if there's enough time to do that because there are some decisions that are made that are not necessarily always correct. We will say this, though, by the way, and we had spoken about it to our listening audience over the last 2 weeks. The chief of the department, by the way, Star Tribune chose not to write about this either, which is interesting. The chief of the department earlier this week met with senior black officers of her department. Apparently, many are saying it was a very productive meeting, good discussion. Some decisions are being contemplated by the chief, Chief Janae Harto, that will begin to heal some of the pain that African-American officers are feeling. Now, at the same time, as we previously reported, and we continue to stand by and support that the Police Federation, under John DeMonaco, a man who I've known since he was a teenager, if you will, growing up in Northeast Minneapolis around the Beltrami community and et cetera, have indicated their concern about the conduct of some of their fellow members. And we shared that on our television program that aired last Sunday and our new edition, which will air tomorrow, that the officers in Green Bay have just been outrageous in rejecting any recommendation. This is for all of you out there that are listening and or those that will call this program upon demand. Yeah, the Federation and some of its top and most respected officers, including some officers that they're pretty tough. I mean, these are pretty tough guys. They bring it. They'll deal with you, duke it out with you. They're not going to brutalize you, etc. Have approached these two officers and have asked them to show some sense of contrition and compassion. And say, man, these two guys out of the Green Bay incident where they attacked black men on the street and actually insulted Green Bay police officers and et cetera, and called called the city of Green Bay a haven for niggers, if you will, and then spoke ill of their own chief with respect to her sexual orientation, et cetera. Well, they have since, and see, nobody wants to write about this because allegedly now it's under investigation and all those kinds of things. They were actually approached by the president, the union attorneys, and a very, very respected fellow officer named Mike Sorrell, who's a lieutenant. I've known him, you know, because folks say, dang, this black man knows everybody. Well, basically almost do. Mike Sorrell, known him since he was a young child, used to come to work with, his father worked at the old community center, there off Lindale, if you will, the Glenwood Lindale Community Center, Nick Sorrell. And even Sorrell, who is really respected, by the way, by the hardliners, went to these two officers, Toll and Powell. Sean Powell, who used to work for the Green Bay Police Department, decided he wanted to come down to Minneapolis because there wasn't enough action in Green Bay because, well, you got to be careful in Green Bay grabbing one of them big black football players, because that's primarily the population. I mean, Green Bay is a 99% white town, you know what I mean? Brown County, where Green Bay is located, and county seat is, you know, 99.3% white, you know. Mike Sorrell, for those of you out there in the police community, Sorrell went to Powell and Throw and asked them to show some sensitivity and understanding of what this was doing. I mean, them cats told him, We don't care nothing about niggers. We don't care nothing about the nigger police. You know, we don't care nothing about our comrades in arms who are African-American officers and get the hell out of our face kind of thing, which is, you know, kind of suicidal because you're expecting if the chief fires you, which she should do, you're kind of expecting that the Federation is going to bring forward them high-powered attorneys, you know what I mean, and defend you and get your job back so that you can go back out on the street again and beat black people and disrespect your fellow black officers, et cetera. And these guys said that, you know, the First Amendment gives them the right to refer to any of us in the African-American community by the N-word, if you will, and to hell with us. Can't you imagine how these two cats, both of them, by the way, are in the National Guard, and there are some questions about how they have conducted themselves while, you know, overseas. I told a friend of mine who is also in the military, I said, these are two cats that if I was in Afghanistan or Iraq, I would not be the point man. Okay, when we got ready to go into the village or come out of the village or our compound, I would not be in front of them. You know what I mean? Unless I was the squad leader, I would have to tell my squad leaders, look, man, I'll back up the rear, okay? I will not be out front of these cats. Because when you think about them and their military service, I mean, you know, Thol and Powell, you kind of wonder, you know, how many of them quote-unquote ragheads that they just put a bullet through their heads, you know, while on duty overseas and things like that. You know, and oh, by the way, both of them have a track record of being involved in the killing of a person of color, African American, or in this case, Somali, in one situation. And so all of this comes into play when you go back now and take a look at the story in yesterday's edition of the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Again, this is kind of exclusive, BFN, Black Freedom Network, because if it isn't told here, it's not going to be told. Now, David Chenin, who has already brought suspicion upon himself because the sources that he identified, for those of you that got them computers and things, you know, you need to call up his and Matt McKinney's story of the 17/18 day of May, where they talked about exclusive and they talked about these sources that they had who had laid out what had happened in the basement. Well, now the story is kind of changing. But the real purpose of the story in yesterday's edition of the Minneapolis Star Tribune, the headline, I tell you, folks, this is front page above the fold for those of you that, you know, are journalism students. Terrence Franklin's DNA found on trigger. Now, of course, they didn't say what kind of DNA it is. Is it blood? Is it human matter, like blood, if you will, or brain matter, because, you know, they blew all his head away. Is it other kinds of DNA? Though the most common DNA in a situation like that will last, that is basically almost of a solid mass kind of thing. You know what I mean? Now, I imagine that Star Tribune and Mr. Chen and others will tell us that it's blood, if you will, that there was blood splatter on the MP5 submachine gun, which allegedly, and there was redundancy in the article. The editor should have did a little better job of maybe editing, if you will, because Mr. Chenin chose to continue to tell this story, which we first revealed and talked about the 11th day of May, the day after Mr. Franklin was killed, and continue to talk about it for at least three consecutive programs, that initially the whole thing that came in the question was that how did Mr. Franklin, after wrestling the gun, I mean, this Mr. Franklin, as my colleague Mr. Allen has said on his blog site from Washington, D.C. this morning, Terrence Franklin had to be one of the better trained special forces personnel in the history of, you know, the special forces, the Rangers, the Navy SEALs, and et cetera, because he, you know, according to the versions now on, once you get you the dates, I mean, correct, in the May 17th edition of the Minneapolis Star Tribune, and now the August 16th edition, about 2 months apart, is that Terrence Franklin engaged in hand-to-hand combat. I mean, yeah. In a closed area, very closed area, in the basement almost in fact in the laundry room of the basement with a dog too. I believe we don't want to forget the dog, because the dog at all times had a hold of Mr. Franklin, particularly in his groin area, right around the testicles area, where dogs are trained to kind of munch on your family jewels, if you will. So you had the dog, which is over 100 pounds, and you had five highly trained officers. I mean, these guys were top of the line. I mean, you know, whenever the department does its PR piece, they, you know, talk about these well-trained. Oh, by the way, our department does not encourage African-American officers to apply to be members of the SWAT team. Actually, there's really been only two members in my memory. And that's, but when I say my memory, I'm talking about in the last 10, 15 years. And so black officers are really encouraged not to bother to become members of the elite unit. In fact, the last African-American, and he knows who I'm talking about, you know, he was forced out and now, you know, doing traffic stops downtown, if you will, not happy. But these are highly trained officers. I mean, extremely highly trained, man. Hand-to-hand combat, if you will. You know, you talk about that, all that Trayvon Martin stuff that came out in the trial with respect to really what is martial arts and et cetera. These guys are highly trained, man. You know, also, they're well protected. They have their bullet-resistant vest on. They have steel-toed shoes. Ooh, you ain't feel no pain, boy, until one of them steel-toed boots kicks you in your ribs, you know, or the back of your behind and breaks your tailbone and your ribs and your wrist and fractures your jaw and et cetera. And also they have, of course, their sidearms, you know what I mean, which allegedly, now here's a part of confusion. Maybe Mr. Chenin and the Star Tribune can answer this question as we go in the next 17 minutes into specific details with specificity. Now, when Mr. Chenin and Mr. McKinney wrote their article back on the 17th of May, they had a scenario in which Mr. Franklin, after being pulled out from behind the water heater in the basement, a very closed area, that with five officers all in immediate, you know, within less than feet, inches in some cases, and there was always this statement and talked about that the officer grabbed Mr. Franklin by his head. He didn't grab him by his head. He grabbed him by his dreadlocks, and he used the dreadlocks as leverage to use his flashlight, big flashlight that these officers carried to beat Mr. Franklin. And we repeat what we said in our broadcast of May 11th, the day after Mr. Franklin was brutally killed in the intervening weeks, that Mr. Franklin was really unconscious, if you will, probably half dead when he was shot in the temple and along the front of his face blown away, if you will. An eye which had been severely damaged by blows to that part of his face with the big flashlight and the boots and everything. And so, you know, couldn't afford to have that be a part of the medical examination because it would raise questions on why his face had been so beaten. So what you do, you just use your machine gun and your handguns, you just blow his head apart. I mean, come on, you know, for those of us that have been out here for the long period of time that we have and watched this over the many, many, many years, you kind of know the modus operandi. So his eye, which had already basically been beaten out of his head, was just basically, you know, destroyed on the left side of his face, if you will. Now, the version on the 17th was that Mr. Franklin had grabbed Officer Duran's MP5, which is supposed to be what is called, for those of you who are military, that was slung, if you will. Some way or another, Mr. Franklin grabbed that MP5, was able to, I assume we'll ultimately be told at some point, maybe we'll get another version, that the strap must have broke. I got to tell you, those straps are extremely tough. I mean, they're difficult to break or do anything else. But anyways, apparently, somewhere or another, Mr. Franklin, and this is the May 17th version, Mr. Franklin was able to get Officer Duran, a highly trained, well-trained officer, get his MP5 away and open fire, shooting two other members of the unit in the legs, which is kind of interesting because maybe the gun he wasn't used to. I mean, this African-American who was highly trained enough to physically fight and almost overwhelm five officers, did not know how to control this MP5 submachine gun, which is a short version. This, we're not talking about like the AR-15, AR-16, or a big shotgun or et cetera. This is a compact, what we call a compact weapon. And so actually it's very easy to control, if you will, particularly if it's on single shot. Oops. See, that was another mistake that was made. If it had been on automatic, then maybe we could play the game that he was not used to an automatic weapon firing in succession, and it got away from him. But it was a single shot. It was on single shot. This is according to David Chen in the Star Tribune and their sources. Go back and take a look at it. So that meant that there had to be individual squeezing, if you will. So Mr. Franklin squeezed off a shot, hit one officer in the leg, squeezed off another shot, hit another officer in the leg, and was getting ready to squeeze off another shot to shoot Officer Duran, who he had taken Officer Duran's gun, when Officer Luke Peterson stepped between them. Now, of course, we haven't gotten into distance or anything like that, but he stepped in between them, and in a heroic effort to save the life of his comrade in arms, he fired a shot. Only problem is Mr. Franklin was shot a whole lot more times than once. And by the way, you know, contrary to what some activists have been saying, he was not shot in the back of the head five times. That did not happen. But he was shot. And, of course, in the May 17th article, which was reconfigurated on the Star Tribune's website just last night, if you will, at approximately, the night before, at approximately 11:13 p.m. Central Daylight Standard Time. But in the May 17th version, Officer Peterson fires a, I assume, single shot to some area of Mr. Franklin's body anatomy or whatever, and he drops. Okay, so that, you know, that seemed to be fairly a clean version. I mean, the Star Tribune did not give us any depth with respect to distance and proximity of all the other officers who had already, of course, been shot. Other officers waiting at the top of the stairs to storm down to deal with this Black Hercules who had almost bested five highly trained officers and the dog. I mean, you got to understand, while all this is going on, the dog, the well-trained police dog, 100 pound if not more, is hanging all over the lower part of the body and you got to realize that also at the point that Mr. Franklin grabbed the weapon, the dog is trained to go at the weapon and at the hands of the individual. So I'm puzzled on how Mr. Franklin was able to bring the gun into any kind of firing position with the doggy on him. I mean, doggy is all over him. I mean, doggy has already ripped his pants and torn his pants and, you know, destroyed his testicles, if you will. So the pain that Mr. Franklin must have been feeling in the seconds before his ultimate death, I mean, had to be excruciating. Would you not think? So this was all the May 17th. Well, lo and behold, in yesterday's edition, which I don't know how many of you paid any attention to it, I think you ultimately will based on this particular broadcast, a new version of something that is now really interesting comes into play. When we now have an admission that a second officer also shot Mr. Franklin. But now here's the puzzling part as we go into the last, you know, minutes of this program. You know, we have 9 minutes. The story, copyrighted. That's always important, man. Copyrighted, you know. Now, we have copyrighted as a spokesman recorder because we are part of that same industry, and these people just plagiarize our materials and our facts. But they now say that a second officer shot Mr. Franklin. Now, for those of you, you got to go get the hard copy of the Star Tribune, see, because you're not going to find that on the website. Now, they may have updated it, but my associate, Mr. Allen, has hard printed that information after accessing it because there was actually, you know, a dispute between he and I because he was reading me what was supposed to be in the paper on Friday morning, and I was saying, no, that's not what's in the paper. I've got the paper here in front of me. This is like at 8 o'clock in the morning, Central Standard Time, 9 o'clock in the morning, Eastern Standard Time, Daylight Time, both times. And we discovered that some of the material of the May 17th article by the Star Tribune had been incorporated, but then under struggle for the weapon, David Chenin kind of changed the description of what happened. Now we have the following. Now, you know, at some point someone needs to be able, and I, you know, Mike Freeman's not going to do it, I can tell you that. He will not. And by the way, the grand jury will be all white. They may put a single African-American or some new immigrant, if you will, on the grand jury. But there will be no people of color. And, of course, the way grand juries operate, there will be no one there to speak for Terrence Franklin. You can rest assured this county attorney is not going to speak for the interest of Terrence Franklin. But the question has to be asked, at what point did Terrence Franklin fire the weapon to hit one of the two officers that he allegedly shot, and that officer returned fire? And at what point, that as that fire was being returned, are we to assume that Officer Luke Peterson simultaneously fired his weapon? I don't know which weapon it'll be that they'll say, either his sidearm or his MP5 or et cetera. And did they fire simultaneously or what? Because initially we were all told that as both officers, not Luke Peterson, but the other two officers, Moreno and the other officer, that as they were hit in the lower legs, that, of course, they immediately went down. In fact, we, on our broadcast of the 18th, we would suggest anybody that wants to do that, go back and listen to our broadcast of the 18th of May. You can do that on demand on Blog Radio. We laid out the scenario that initially they were going to go with regards to the second officer was actually shot as officers continued to fire at Mr. Franklin as he laid on the floor, and the bullet ricocheted and hit that officer. Actually, the ricochets hit both officers. But I want you, my friends, over the next 5 minutes as we approach the end of this program, you think about this, particularly those of you with military and paramilitary experience, if you will, that one of the officers wounded by Mr. Franklin had fired his weapon, wounding Mr. Franklin, obviously, I guess not fatally. That was left up to Officer Peterson. And what was the sequential with this? What was the timeline? You know, and where were they firing from? One of the things that we have said, and we will continue to look at this as we move closer to the dates of the 9th through the 12th. That will be the dates that the grand jury in Hennepin County here in the state of Minnesota will be meeting to receive and review and examine evidence in the death of Terrence Franklin. Now, that's the dates that were provided in a letter to the parents of Mr. Franklin 4 days ago. Want to get it all right. They sent the letter 2 days before Mr. Chenin was authorized to reveal the story. Now, the question in conclusion that folks need to look at, and we're sorry that we didn't open the phone lines today. We just felt it was imperative to get as much detail out there to at least raise your curiosity, if you have any, is that you just have to ask yourself the question, at what point were these shots exchanged now between police officers, some wounded, by the way, and Mr. Franklin, if you will, and how many shots were actually fired? How many? Let me say it like this, as we said back on the 18th and the 25th of May. How many shell casings were found? And now let us quickly go to the DNA. Come on. The DNA that was found allegedly on the trigger. Now, you have to understand that DNA can emerge and stick as it pertains to a surface or anything else in any number of ways. Particularly if in the case of being shot and bullet hits an artery or et cetera, I mean, it explodes like a fountain, if you will. Now, here's the question that I ask, based on my sources. Why, if Mr. Franklin had the weapon, he had wrestled it away in a superhuman way from Officer Durant. He had used Officer Durant's weapon to fire at Officer Durant or towards Officer Durant, shot another officer before he in turn was shot and killed by Officer Peterson. Why is there blood spatter in the nozzle of the MP5? Now, that would basically indicate that the splatter came from the front of the gun towards the gun and into the nozzle and along, quote-unquote, the barrel, if you will. And really, a MP5 does not really have a barrel. As we said, it's a very compact a weapon. But why would there be blood splatter in the nozzle, Mr. Franklin's blood splatter, by the way, in the nozzle of the MP5 if he was holding it, pointing it? Now, we submitted, maintained that the majority of the DNA that was retrieved from Mr. Franklin as he lay dead on that floor was carefully taken over to the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and then over the last 3 months, quote-unquote, arranged in such a way as to show up, quote-unquote, on the trigger of the weapon, if you will. Now, as we said back on the 17th to our friends at the Star Tribune, based on how the information, the sources identified on the 17th, I imagine they'll change the scheme this time around. That information was securely contained and controlled in computers, in which only the password was known to the homicide investigators in the unit. We asked this question back on the 18th of May and the 25th. How was Mr. Chinnan and his sources able to access the information in the homicide unit's computer? How did they obtain the password? How did they obtain the information that the Minneapolis Star Tribune, that Mr. Chinnan and his associate, who did not participate in the writing of the story yesterday, how did they obtain that information, and why did not both the county attorney and the city attorney for the city of Minneapolis raise questions legally about how the Minneapolis Star Tribune retained that information? I repeat again, statement that I made as early as the 18th day of May, and that was that the information that the Star Tribune reported was secured information, and that the only way that information could have been obtained and passed on was that someone breached the security of the homicide unit's quote-unquote computer system, was able to obtain access computer through the use of the password. Who would have the password? Is that the reason, in closing, that a reporter from Channel 4 was seen in a very interesting discussion with the former commander of the 4th Precinct, who is now in the civilian community and, intervention team? Why were they together passing information back and forth in front of the chief's office late last week? Interesting question. These questions will never be answered. And as we said in a column in the last minute of this program, again in one of our columns where we talked in terms of expectations as it pertains to the grand jury, none of these questions will be asked. No bill will be returned, and the family will then have to depend on Mike Freeman. Excuse me, I'm sorry, all these Mike. Mike Patton, the attorney of record for the family, to file an appropriate civil action in the courts. But there will not be, you can rest assured, there will be no true bill returned against these police officers. But now we must ask the question, if an officer fired and returned fire and also shot Mr. Franklin, at what point did he engage in that kind of firefight? Or did he, and was he one of the ones that shot Mr. Franklin as he laid on the floor already dead? Think about it, my friends. We didn't write the column. We here, you understand, and On Point, Black Focus and others, we didn't write the column. The Minneapolis Star Tribune did, based on information they said they gained from sources within, quote-unquote, the county attorney's office now and the Minneapolis Police Department. Again, a shout-out to our friends who did a beautiful thing with 21 bikes being given to 21 children. By the way, it was a very interracial, quote-unquote, dissemination. Bison, et cetera. Lisa Clemens is to be commended for a job well done. Hopefully our associate, Mr. Allen, will be back from the East, if you will, and we will join you once again next Saturday from our corporate studio as we talk about the future of the Minneapolis Police Department. Stay strong, Black Minneapolis. Somebody needs to pray for you. Good afternoon. Good evening.